And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Daryl Hamamoto about his book, Servitors of the Empire, Studies in the Dark Side of Asian America. And of course, we're going to continue to talk a little bit more now about the University of California, what really goes on there, the how you've been subjected, of course, to some of the criticism here. How long have you been speaking publicly about this now, and what has happened so far?
I've been speaking to these issues since about 2005, after I came back from sabbatical. I had a year off to really rethink my positions on certain key issues. And as I begin to re-educate myself, reading the vast literature on New World Order history, topics, theory, and so forth, I started integrating it into my my undergraduate curriculum, and right across all the different courses, they begin to be informed by what I call the New World Order theoretical perspective. It started coming to the attention of the administration thanks to a network of student informants, or snitches, as we call them out here, that are being encouraged by the university to rat out their professors. This is like Weimar Germany. And at the same time, within my department, there are interests within there that are threatened, particularly one individual who has set himself as a mental health specialist. And I think most of us understand some of the problems with so-called mental health, because the mental health component of the University of California, I'm sure it's probably similar to other institutions, has really exploded in order to help pacify students, to stigmatize and put them into the health system. It's a Soviet-style mental health system. And it, not coincidentally, started getting into the university at the point where student protests were mounting. They said, okay, we're going to chill these people out by giving them a combination of drugs and therapy. So I'm ardently anti-psychotropic drugs, anti-SSRIs. I warn my students about them because they are, especially the women, are the primary market target for psychotropics. I think about 70% of the women in my class have either been on or have been or will be on psychotropics. The university doesn't like that. They do research in psychotropics and hallucinogenic drugs. They have student health services on campuses that dispense these medications, all part of the pacification process. And for the young men, they are labeled ADDD, right? Attention deficit disability. Mm-hmm. And they're given Ritalin and other brands of drugs in order to really prevent them from being vital young men, turn them into zombies. So on those levels, I've been very aggressive. More recently, I've been talking about the GLBT agenda in class, and again, this information through the network of student informants is leaking back to the administration. And the administration at my particular campus, it's probably very similar to the other nine UC campuses or other colleges and universities across the United States. My campus, they already have in place a GLBT leadership, with the exception, I think, of the president, the mad gasser, Linda Katehi, who ordered the, some of your listeners might remember, in 2011, when a number of student protesters were hosed down by gas, and they were temporarily blinded and crippled. But beyond that, most of the high-level administrators on my campus identify with the GLBT establishment. And again, I think that's consistent with this larger strategy. It has nothing to do with being gay, lesbian, or trans. It's about control. Really.
Exactly. Yes.
They're using the GLBT agenda to shut me up, brand me a homophobe, gay unfriendly, whatever it might be. But Henrik, I'm here to tell you that most of my students are not buying it. They're not going along with the program. They're silenced in their classes, but yeah. With me, they can be open about it. And they said, no, this is not our reality. This is not our life. We understand now that you break it down for us that this is a form of social engineering that's being taught to us, and we are going to resist it. So that's the good news.
And that's also why you're so dangerous to them, of course, because you're actually managed to put some sense into the perspective here and actually show that there's a flip side to this issue, as it is with all issues out there.
Absolutely. I said the fact that the administration and the United Auto Workers want to have gender-free restrooms has nothing to do with gender equality. It has everything to do with humiliation, concentration camp-style humiliation, to make sure that your most intimate and personal functions are under public scrutiny by anybody and everybody. Okay. So I'm predicting that there will be a sea change. There will be a revolution towards this agenda here, only if people come forward, professors, students, graduate students, to say, no, we're not going to go along with this program. And hopefully myself, the people that appear on your program, will provide them the research, the scholarship, the books and the material that will help to substantiate the fact that this is a concerted effort to re-engineer the future professionals of the state of California and the U.S., the University of California. This is nothing less than a complete and total attempt to re-engineer their behavior and their thoughts.
Oh boy, it's we've been trying to pin down and find also a couple of other university professors that can speak about the transformation as well of the educational system and how that happened, how that occurred, and we talked about it before in the program, the cultural Marxism that exists within the university environment at this stage. Do you have any idea of how this happened? And because it hasn't always been so, right? So this has been a kind of a takeover, and it's been a point of actually using, as you educate the university students, you start using them as political tools, and you know that two, three generations from now, a majority of people that are educated in this kind of system, they're going to be on board with the agenda, right? So how does this takeover happen, do you think?
Well, I'm glad you raised that issue, because the problem did not begin in the 1960s with cultural Marxism. From my own research into the University of California, this could be a separate article or maybe even a book tentatively called The Occult University. Most of your listeners know about Yale University and the Skull and Bones and the Order of Death, right? They get all the publicity and the focus. But what your listeners might not know is that the University of California, from my research, is Skull and Bones West. So at its origins, this New World Order globalist occultic perspective is ingrained in the very foundation of the University of California, whose motto is Fiat Lux, right? Let there be light.
Yeah.
They didn't say what kind of light. It's probably Luciferian light. That's what I'm finding out now.
Yeah.
And the institution was founded in 1868, right after, around the time of the end of the American Civil War. And what I found is that the second or third president, he was really at bottom, really the founding president of the University of California. He's a gentleman by the name of Daniel Coit, C-O-I-T, Gilman, G-I-L-M-A-N. Daniel Coit Gilman. He is a graduate of Yale University. He was a member of Skull and Bones. He was also one of the co-founders of the Russell Trust. And I don't think I need to explain to your listeners the significance of that connection. And of course, the Russell Trust made much of its fortune from East Asia, from the opium trade between southern China and central China and the U.S. I think that's one of the reasons why the Yale people said, hey, we better get an institution out there in the far west in California so we can benefit by this. I don't know. I wasn't a party to their secret meetings. And hence began the large influx of Asians from that part of the world. And from there, the University of California, since the mid-19th century, has been very much part, because it's facing the Pacific Ocean, the nations of the Pacific Rim. The University of California has taken a leadership in the U.S. academic establishment in bringing forward the so-called, what Henry Luce called, the publisher of Time and Life magazine, called the Pacific Century. It's poised there. It's faced there. It's in the San Francisco Bay. It's in Berkeley, but it's facing that area. Most of the military and economic campaigns against us, beginning with the Philippines all the way through World War II and the Cold War, a lot of it had been workshopped at the University of California which also enjoys a close institutional relationship with the well-known Bohemian Grove, which is not that far away from the UC campus.
Huh.
I believe Napa County. And so this is where all the masters of commerce and the engineers and educators met each summer to plan out their future empire. And then more recently, this started I think in the 1980s, and it's really going strong today in 2014. The University of California is really at the center of the China century, which the globalists have mapped out for us, so that China will be now the next great world power, while the United States diminishes in its economic capacity. And that is seen in the large number of students from the People's Republic of China whose families have been enriched by gobs and gobs of cheap American dollars that they need to recycle. So they send their kids to the University of California. A lot of them are coming to Davis. Some of them are serious. Most of them are, well, I wouldn't say most, but a large number are not. They're also, the Chinese government is also creating a network of what they call Confucius establishment. I forgot the name, Confucius Centers,
I think it's called the Confucius Institute, right?
Institute, yeah, I think that's it. And some universities have been declining the money because of all the different strings that are attached. UC Davis has a small one. In order to facilitate this process of hollowing out American manufacturing and even services too, for our educated professionals, their services are also going to be offshore. They're already in the process of doing that as part of the China century. So yeah, to answer, go back to your original question. Yeah, the University of California at its inception is connected to these Illuminists, and quite literally, that's their slogan, the Illuminist origins. And they go with the flow. If the civil rights movement is great, they'll weaponize race. If the women's movement comes, great, we'll weaponize gender. GLBT, which the Bay Area was taking, took a leadership role in the cultural and political movements of the gay liberation period, then we'll go with that. If China is taking the lead, we'll figure out a way to profit from that.
So we have to see through that. We have to see through this particular aspect and try to, in that regard, see past our own level of identification to get smart to this agenda. Otherwise, they will use whoever they can. And of course, the group that is being used at the moment think, aha, great, finally, you know, it's our time now. We're getting ahead, right? And while that momentarily might be the correct assumption of it, in the long run, in the long term, not so. This is quite the opposite.
Yeah, they'll be busted out in due time. That ascendant group will be just like China. It's going to be very interesting to see the very two cagey global empires circling each other to see who's going to drop first. but I think it's a really important to see through these different levels, but also to recognize, as I alluded to earlier, the occult power and force that binds this institution together. People, thinkers like Lorraine Morey have written about this. Incidentally, she was in a PhD program at UC Davis for a time until I think she was, for the most part, driven out. There's a really good book by a writer named Gray Bretchen called Imperial San Francisco that talks about the defining role of the University of California in creating the seeds of the globalist empire. But to get back to my other point about the occultic element, I mentioned a correspondence to you that the Mondavi family has had a longstanding interest at the University of California, Davis in specific. And the reason for that is that the University of California, Davis was started in 1905 as the agricultural station unit of the University of California. It didn't become its own general campus until I think the mid-50s. But the Mondavi clan, Robert Mondavi is the godfather. He passed away not too long ago, I guess, benefited by that proximity because this is where the global wine industry had its genesis. And it grew to such great importance that the Rothschild family itself has formed a partnership with the Mondavi clan. They have a winery in the heart of the California wine country. They have, they have a research facility. The Mondavis do. They have a research facility doing so-called food science research. Most of it's probably GMO and other Frankenfood types of products, re-engineered products. And they also have a performing arts center, the Mondavi, which the university is quite proud of. Now, I teach my students that this is what stands behind these buildings. This is what's behind the Mondavi Fortune. This is the role that the University of California, Davis plays in supporting the global takeover of the wine industry and putting small producers out of business all over the world. Now, there's a great documentary. It's called Mondovino that traces that process. Your listeners might want to take a look at that one.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow. What a bizarre and really interesting. So what's the bigger, how does this tie into the bigger picture here in terms of the, I think it's called the Opus One Winery, right? That's
correct.
And so is this being used in another way? Is it through, of course, the alcohol industry in itself is huge. A lot of the, families like the Bacardi, and of course you have Seagram's, what is that family called again? I forget the name of it. But there are a number of families in which have profited hugely on the alcohol industry. I think even actually you talked about that in the beginning of the book, the process of banning the alcohol in the beginning, right, was also part of the mob to actually get a lot of the funding for their activities, right? So is this involved in everything here?
The classic mobs, the ethnic-based mobs, Sicilian and other different groups, Irish Catholic, the Kennedys were also involved in liquor, as you know, the Kennedy clan. Those have, for the most part, been absorbed by Wall Street mob. So they've gravitated into the legitimate economy now. And that's what Mondavi is doing, I think, in order to launder his reputation, has forged institutional alliances with places like UC Davis. This is a common strategy, by the way. Families, entities will launder their ill-gotten gains through respectable institutions such as hospitals, such as universities, and similar, because it gives them, because most of the public from the outside looks at a place like the University of California and they look at it in awe and wonder and admiration and don't really understand that it's really a machine for these very, very powerful forces. It's also a financial machine. One of the looming crises, and I think my colleagues are beginning to see what I've been yammering about for the past few years. One of the looming crises is that the University of California has a huge, huge retirement fund. And the globalists, the Wall Streeters, are just licking their chops, trying to figure out a way how to steal that from us without having a bunch like 18,000 PhDs screaming and suing their pants off. What they've done, the UC people, they've stocked the Regents with a bunch of money men. UCLA is one of the campuses, University of California, Los Angeles, and it's in the heart of the entertainment business. So the new governor, Jerry Brown, he is trained by the Society of Jesus. This is the second time he's been the governor of California, by the way. But he has recruited numbers of celebrities and actors and people related to the show business community, like David Geffen, who has, by the way, a medical facility named after him at UCLA on the UCLA campus, to join that of the Jules Stein Eye Institute, also at the UCLA campus. And Jules Stein, you might recall his name. He was with the Capone mob. He was the founder of MCA.
Right.
He sent one of his lieutenants out to Hollywood, Lou Wasserman, who became known as Mr. Hollywood. Him and his wife, Edie, were the conduit between Hollywood and Washington, D.C., and big supporters of the Democratic Party. That's Jules Stein. He has a facility on the UCLA campus. He is a medical doctor by training, by profession, I guess. I don't know if he really practiced, but he was a top-level person at the mob at that point. So more recently, they have brought forward this woman by the name of Sherry Lansing as part of the trustees, and she has promised to bring tons of money into the university from all these different celebrities. She was a former CEO of, can't remember, some film studio, very prominent and important person in the film industry. She's also married to the director, William Friedkin, who, as most of your listeners would know, would recognize that name as attached to the classic film, The Exorcist. So this is the model that they're using. They're bringing in tons of Chinese students who are paying out-of-state fees to subsidize undergraduate education. At the same time, they're forging high-level alliances with the entertainment community. And in order to satisfy its appearance, its charter as a public institution, the universities, I think, and I have no way of documenting this, but this is speculation, they're ready to bring in tons and tons of the children of illegal immigrants into the University of California system. Whether they're qualified academically or not, they're going to bring them in, and no one's going to complain. No one's going to say anything because we do not want to be accused of being racist or anti-Mexican. And toward that end, again, using the ethnicity and race as a tool, the university is also, in addition to stocking the upper level administration with GLBT identified people, they're also bringing in lots of Latinos and Latinas at that level, so they can facilitate that process.
Right. Yeah.
By the way, Asian Americans are not represented in the upper level administration, even though we are 40%, let's say, of the student population. We're way overrepresented, but we have zero political participation. That defaults to Latinos and African Americans, who are, you know, which kind of confounds the whole race, ethnicity system, because, you know, technically Asian Americans are also non-white, but we're still represented in the student body, not in the faculty, and definitely not the administration.
Is that intentional? So again, that they could use it later, do you think, or is there another reason for that?
I haven't really been able to sniff out what the motivation is. I think the priority is right now is to figure out a way to hollow out and to stress the undergraduate education by bringing in large numbers of first-generation immigrants who are children of primarily Mexican migrant labor. Because the from what I'm seeing, the undergraduate education component of the University of California is slated for maybe not destruction, but serious downsizing.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. The rest of it's going to be left for research for the Mondavi family and people like that.
Yeah, well, exactly. Okay. Is that the goal of it? Where do you see that this is developing here in future years?
Well, one of the big agenda items is the bioscience economy. In our part of California, Northern California, there was a bio, an IT explosion. There was a big boom on Wall Street. They pumped up the stocks, and of course that went bust after a while. So the next big thing is the biosciences economy. So there's tons of money, new buildings, research facilities being built on the UC campus. It's probably similar to other UC campuses, like in UC Davis, but they're trying to build up that bubble. They're trying to get Wall Street sold on this new speculative bubble. And this doesn't include any sort of participation from your undergraduates. These are mostly going to be researchers from overseas and graduate students from overseas, largely. Most of your PhD students are, I think, not U.S. citizens. So they're creaming the intellectual labor, the cream of the crop from foreign countries. And at the undergraduate level, it's mostly going to be fun and games at the Student Recreation Center, at Student Services, and you'll have your own rooms for whatever types of identity politics you want to practice. Well, at the same time, the real business of the University of California is being conducted behind these laboratory doors.
Oh boy! Now, what would you say to those who have their allegiances with America? What do you suggest them to do? I mean, it's the government and state organizations, education, and everything else so infiltrated by the people who are running the New World Order agenda that we talked about before? Is it beyond a point of where you can't repair it anymore? Is it time to set up something else, something true? I mean, the state of the nation overall in the system, everywhere at this stage, at least in the Western world, is kind of crumbling before our eyes. What is to happen with it? Where are we to go?
Well, the University of California, because of its prominence within the regional as well as state and maybe even national economy, is only going to be allowed to degenerate to a certain level. They're just letting some of the what in their minds are the non-essential parts just kind of wither away at the vine. The research component will remain strong. More money will be brought into it. But it's going to be serving a very, very narrow interest. Again, it's an extension of this controlled infrastructure that's being put in place. Now, unfortunate for them, there seems to be significant pushback by states within the U.S. as well as foreign countries like China, which are saying, no, we're not going to accept any more GMO crops that are being developed at the University of California School of Agriculture. We're not going to do it. They didn't anticipate that, I don't think. This is going to put a severe crimp in their long-range plans. They thought that this was going to go through unopposed. And by the way, I know from my students who are in biology and the sciences, who take my classes as well, tell me the propaganda effort is relentless in favor of genetically modified crops and organisms.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
They're trying to, more than anything else, rather than imparting any sort of specific science information, are trying to impart a worldview to my students, to young people. And it's probably the same everywhere. But as if you're reading even the mainstream press right now, we have states like Hawaii that says we are not going to accept GMOs. Vermont is very close. The state of Vermont and the U.S. is very close to banning GMOs. China is routinely beginning to refuse GMO corn, and they used to be pro-GMO. They should at least accept it. They're now finding out that this is a stealth weapon that's going to eventually take down their civilian population, just like they've almost succeeded here in the U.S. So I have some causes of optimism. We do have some sectors within my particular campus in the larger UC that are receptive to these ideas that I'm beginning to put forth. However, there still is an older generation, older guard that you alluded to earlier, who identify with what has been called cultural Marxism. These are people that came into academia on the heels of the student radical agitation during the 1960s. And like any other intellectual or scholar or most people, they just cannot retool. They cannot understand that the Frankfurt School has been proven wrong for the most part, and all the different systems that they have advanced, political system, economic system, have been abject failures. But they're still there. They're still sitting at the coffee shop waiting for the great proletarian revolution. And as a result, that leaves a huge vacuum for me, because the students want. They said it's not happening. Now, Gramsci was great, Marcuse great, fine, Horkheimer. And by the way, a lot of my friends are of that ilk. They're experts in these fields. They've edited books by them. These are my friends. These are my colleagues.
Wow.
And I bring my ideas by them, and they're horrified on the one hand, but at the second time, I also have their attention. Because they are at least savvy enough to know that something is not going right, and the Frankfurt School theory is not going to take us where we need to go.
But it has been very successful, though, right? To this extent, to this degree, with the critical theory, of course, and also just the idea of trying to, be a corrosive force on the Western world. It's in that regard, I consider it a success, because it's happening right now. right?
Yeah, it's a generational success. It comes out of the 60s. I mean, there are some younger Frankfurt people. I think most of the people of the recent generation were diverted by so-called literary theory, as opposed, and a lot of it, of course, relates to the Frankfurt School theory. But what I'm anticipating is that there's going to be such huge economic, social, cultural dislocation that people are going to be start listening to Red Eyes Radio and alternative, so-called alternative, which is now, I think, probably the mainstream. It's just not mainstream in academia yet.
Right.
So I see this as an incredible opportunity, an incredible moment in time where our ideas can be put forth to the new generation where it's going to have the most impact. In other words, I really don't, you know, yeah, they had a big impact. They produced a lot of work. They've had a lot of deleterious effects on the culture and society. I'm speaking of the Frankfurt School, but they've had their day in the sun. It's over. It's gone. You know, they're operating on fumes now. And young people, the more intelligent ones, are beginning to understand that.
Well, that's very encouraging. I guess to a certain extent, I've been staring myself blind on the tutors as opposed to the students, I guess, in that regard, and feel you know, wow, I just, what is happening? You know, everyone is being educated in this. But if it's as you say, it's if there's kind of an inherent resistance there, that, I mean, that's excellent. And it's just not a kind of a new version of this, an updated one that has happened so many times. This is a genuine sentiment of seeing through the lies that we've been fed, you think?
Yeah, this is a genuine break between these enshrined orthodoxies that came from the left. Again, you know, your tutors are from that previous new left generation, right?
Yeah.
These are people who are holdovers from that, and that's their story, and they're going to stick with it. And I see them at, you know, at the coffee shops in Berkeley, and you know, they're perpetually locked in this mode, this model. Young people are struggling. They're putting two or three jobs together. They have graduate degrees and having problems. They can see on an empirical, on a very mundane level that this so-called theory is just not working. It's not operative. And they're also beginning to see that all the orthodoxies and the political correctness that were propounded 20 years ago, 30 years ago, as it concerns race and ethnicity and gender, are also no longer operative. So there's a genuine quest I'm seeing, talking to students, not amongst my colleagues. Yeah, absolutely not. there's a genuine quest amongst young people for new sources of knowledge and information. And by the way, they even think that this type of work that I'm involved with is cool.
Wow.
You imagine that? Yes.
Well, that's amazing. I heard someone else say as well, though, on top of this, that like, yeah, good, you know, we shouldn't go to these schools and get, you know, indoctrinated, accumulate the student loans and come out with three degrees and still ending up serving Big Macs. You know, it's like a kind of a defeatist purpose but there is a more of an individual effort of actually making it on your own these days. And with the web available and web businesses and everything else, that's another channel as well, I guess, for young people, as opposed to going the traditional route and getting the traditional education, right?
That's precisely the case. In fact, I'll even admit that I encourage my students to drop out of the university, at least for the first couple years or so, and see if they can get their own enterprise going. Now, we're fortunate in that Asian Americans across the U.S. have a much higher rate of self-employment in family businesses than other groups.
That's great.
Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful. And I want to build on that. And what they're being taught at the university is that, oh, no, you have to get a corporate job. You have to work for Genentech. You have to go work for the military or for the government. That's a safe job. It's an American job. And so an American job is being self-sufficient.
Exactly.
Having a family-based business. You have the restaurants. You have the nail salons. You have the auto mechanics. Keep that. Build on that. I said that is the foundation for the health of any community, Asian American or not. And that's exactly what the university wants to deprive you of. They want to make you feel guilty for living, for being in an ethnic type economy. I said, but that is, you know, it's counterintuitive, but you need to explore that. Maybe you can help your family build on that system. So I said, I encourage them. In fact, I'm trying to develop a undergraduate program in small business entrepreneurialism. And there are technologies, as you found out, like on the web-based, where this is possible, whether it's entertainment, news, information, specialty niche types of services. I think I see this as opportunities. And so I'm trying to build on that that foundation. That's one of the positive aspects of Asian American ethnicity that that I am trying to promote. And my colleagues support that, by and large, because they are beginning to feel guilty by taking tens of thousands of dollars of undergraduate money and getting nothing out of it. And indeed, yeah. In our area or our region, I read this in the local newspaper, the Sacramento Bee, that it costs now more to get a 4 years of a UC Davis education than it does to buy a single family home in wow. the Sacramento area. Phew. It's that bad. Wow. And they're not going to be able to, or at great hardship. They're not, you're going to have a great, a difficult time trying to pay back that money.
And that's again, you know, operated by the same Wall Street gangsters at this stage, I believe. There's been a huge, I mean, it was what, the second or third industry in America a while back, I heard, or something like that?
Yes. Crazy. And like the housing bubble that burst in the United States a few years ago, the next bubble to burst is the higher education bubble.
Yeah.
And this is why Jerry Brown, the governor of California currently, has all his cronies on the trustees who are connected to Wall Street so they can figure out how to bust the bubble, profit from it, while escaping any sort of blame or responsibility for being behind this intrigue.
Wow.
In addition to the pension. That's really going to be, unfortunately, Henrik, that's going to be the closer in my argument for my colleagues. Once they wake up one day and find out that much of their pension, their retirement fund is gone, which, by the way, is ours. We earned it. It's just deferred income. It's not something that the government has given us. We earned it yep. by the of our own sweat. They're going to wake up and see it. Then they say, oh, I guess that crackpot Hamamoto was right, you know, as well. Just like he was right that we were going into lockdown. We were going into Homeland Security mode. They found I was proven right when Janet Napolitano showed up. She rode up one day on her horse and set up shop in Oakland, California. Now she's the president of the UC system.
Oh, boy, really?
Yes, Janet Napolitano, formerly of the Department of Homeland Security, who was run out of there because of her and her female attendants were sexually harassing the heterosexual male
yeah.
in the Department of Justice. And I think they settled out of court. And what happened? The UC trustees have promptly invited her to come to the UC because there are going to be a lot of pissed off PhDs. And we also have law schools, by the way. We have lots of trained attorneys
yeah, right.
in law schools. We have medical doctors. We have a range of very bright, motivated, and articulate professionals who are not going to take their being screwed over lightly. So they have to bring in Big Sister, Janet Napolitano, to be in place when the hammer comes down.
Wow, that's pretty amazing, actually. I did not know that. So
yes.
So how do you see the structure around all of this happening from the point of view of America, I guess, in terms of the expansion of the control state and everything else? Is this going to just be, it's just going to get worse from this on out and there's, or is there, are you positive nonetheless of the more they try to clamp down on this, the more they try to, you know, impose and enforce, the more people are going to wake up and consequently ask questions and some kind of resistance to this is going to be possible?
I believe that there's enough of the indigenous American spirit of resistance that remains that these individuals are going to be pushed back into the hole until they can find a more convenient time to reemerge and run because they never go away fully.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
They're by definition a power, a force, an entity. So we'll have to push them back into their hole for a little bit while longer because remember, whatever issues that immigrant people, whether from Asia or Latin America, bring with them, they are also the most motivated and the most desperate and the most invested in America that is healthy, vibrant, and presents opportunities for them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we can build on those values while trying to show them the errors of the pure symbolic, theatrical, ethno-nationalistic displays. Right? We can build on this human, inherent human capacity for excellence, striving, perseverance. I think that's universal. And that's where I see our hope. It's coming from this new incoming generation of college age. I don't necessarily, they don't have to be in college, but college age, university age, young people in America.
Very, very interesting. Now, I don't want to switch too much on the topic here in case there's more, of course, what we could talk about here. But I briefly wanted to ask you a little bit about Sterling Seagrave's work. I think you have it's the second chapter, I believe, as well. We talk about the Song clan and everything that happened there. How do you tie that into this picture?
Well, part of my argument there is that high-level Asians and Asian Americans have been an integral part of American empire and the New World Order system by extension. Very early on, the founding father of the Song dynasty, which later became the ruling family of Formosa and then Taiwan, their family of bankers and opium traders and whatnot, politicians, political figures. The founding father, his American name is Charlie Song, came to the U.S. shortly after the American Civil War. And he's a founding father. But at the same time, in my field, Asian American Studies, they primarily look at the experience of working people, which is okay, but it's a lopsided perception. We've had power players at the highest levels, the highest reaches from the very beginning, because criminality is the original multicultural, multiracial enterprise, right? People want to make money, they'll get in bed with anybody, whoever they are.
Yeah.
And that's true in America, the Sicilians and the Jews and the Greeks and the Irish and Chinese, they collaborate, they work together so this is true with the Song. I call them, well, Sterling Seagrave calls them the Song dynasty. I encourage your listeners to explore the research of Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. He also has an excellent book. They're a husband and wife writing team, an excellent book called Gold Warriors.
Yes.
And that's about the secret financing of the post-war Japanese government and also the secret history of the black budget or financing of the American political system as well. And in one of the chapters, which I call Double Suicide, I talk about the Seagraves in conjunction with the death of the famed Asian American author named Iris Chang, who was found with a gunshot wound. Some of us suspect that she might have been murdered, but Iris Chang, I think, was getting close to information linking the U.S. government with this larger World War II, post-World War II financing scheme where massive treasures were stolen and taken and never repatriated to the countries that were looted by Japan.
That's right. And I've heard so many different angles to the story of what happened to the gold, if it was, or the treasure, I guess, in that extent, but primarily gold, how this was brought out or over to the U.S. or even some other wild speculation that this was some kind of quest of a well-meaning agenda that they tried to store away the gold for a later day for the benefit of the rest of the planet and everything else. Anything you can comment on in regards to that?
Well, this much is known, according to not only Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, but other researchers. And for the sake of convenience, this treasure is usually called Yamashita's gold.
That's right.
It was the Japanese general who was assigned to take these, not just gold, but treasures, precious metals, artworks, jewels, and so forth, and hide them away in different locations in the Philippines. Which, by the way, according to the Seagraves, helped the rise of figures, dictators like Ferdinand Marcos. But a lot of that money, according to these writers, was the basis for political fortunes of people like President Richard Nixon and other people that followed him. And it's part of, by implication, a larger black budget, an off-the-books budget that is funding a lot of these different types of activities. So in a sense, the Federal Reserve is really kind of a red herring. That's for our consumption. The globalists are operating on a different financial system. A lot of it, which is predicated or based upon this gold that Yamashita had helped accumulate.
Yeah.
And Iris Chang, unfortunately, I think she was doing a book on World War II U.S. veterans who were part of the Bataan Death March in the Philippines. And she was electronically harassed. She was dosed with powerful hallucinogenic drugs, which, as I stated earlier, I'm an ardent opponent of. And her parents brought her to the worst place possible for treatment, psychiatric treatment. That's Stanford University. Because Stanford University is mind control central. It's SRI. It's also related to Pentagon Valley, as I call it, or Silicon Valley. And then she took a turn for the worse there, and she descended into this psychiatric hell from which she never emerged until she died.
Oh boy,
yeah,
got a little bit too close to to where the lead was going. It's just you have a lot of good chapters in the book, and I really recommend it. People pick up a copy and read more. About all the things we've really just kind of scraped the surface on some of the things that you go into in the book, and you have a very, very eloquent writing way and the way you lay certain things out, and of course connect the dots and see through a lot of the things as well. And you lend both from all across the political spectrum. Really, it's not really about this, that, or the other. It's about presenting a cohesive picture and borrowing from whatever you can to paint the reality of the situation. So that's another aspect that I appreciate in the book as well.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your comments. And I should state that the final chapter is about the murder of John Lennon.
That's right. Exactly. There's so much more, of course, in the book that we didn't. Maybe we can have you back at some point as well and talk more about some of the things, Daryl, as we begin to wrap things up a little bit for this time here, because there's just much more to it. By the way, tell us a bit more about some of the upcoming books you have as well. There's potentially two, maybe even three, you said, you're working on?
Yes. We talked about the New World Order theory for students. It's going to be sort of a chapbook format. That is a smaller format that students can pop into their backpacks and be seen at the cafes looking cool, reading it, instead of staring into their smartphones. There's that. And I would also like to do some research on the occult underpinnings of the University of California. I have a lot more information here that I've told you about, and I'm here at Ground Zero observing all this. And I have a number of other projects as well that I'm trying to do. I also do music and do creative work and film and video. I have the dubious distinction of having done the first all Asian American erotic film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I feel it's I'm duty bound as an intellectual to tweak the nose of the powers in the beast. You know what? If they get rid of me now, you know, I got my licks in while I could, and I've gotten away with quite a bit. I hope to do a lot more. A lot of it is intentionally funny and humorous and parodic, so I can kind of get away with it. But my work is now taking a much more dark and serious turn. So I don't know. We'll see. I'd like to come back to and be on your show. I'd really enjoy that opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. You bet. It's going to be great to have you back and continue our conversation and talk more about all the things we didn't have time for this time. But nonetheless, in the meantime, then we'll relay people further to some of the websites that we give out here. Of course, the publisher. Trinedate.com, that's where you can pick up copies of the book, and it's called Servitors of Empire, and we're going to have that linked up on the website as well. And then we had a couple of other websites as well, among the other ones, scrolling down here, but fightthetower.com, and also, of course, universityofcalifornia.edu. Well, thank you so much, Daryl, for coming on. Really, really appreciate your perspective, some great insight, and please keep up the good work and keep your head high, because you're doing good work there at the university. So keep going at it as long as you can, and keep trying to talk sense into some of your students for as long as you can as well.
Henrik, I appreciate your support, and I look forward to shaking your hand at the end of June in San Mateo, California.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
And that concludes our program for today. Our next guest is Mikkel Clair Nissen from Denmark, with a perspective on Danish society and a critical view on the much-celebrated collectivist model. We'll speak on the psychology behind the control and analysis of the arrested development that the majority of the grown-ups in the Scandinavian countries suffer from. This is an ailment brought on by state education and indoctrination. Thank you for listening and for being a member. We do appreciate your support, but also, more importantly, your interest and dedication to learning about these subjects and, of course, questioning the established views. All right, we'll be back in just a few days. Have a good rest of your day. We'll speak more soon.